The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Siegel, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 8th panel. This is our second case on for oral argument this morning, and I'll just remind the parties that although we are holding these proceedings online by Zoom and we can see each other's faces and we can see the names, our audio recording of the proceedings will strictly be audio. And so it's still necessary for you to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can attach your argument to you. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time for the appellant's lawyer. And we ask that you be mindful of those timing restrictions. If there are any technological issues along the way, it's glitchy or you can't hear us or we can't hear you or you can't hear one of your any of the panel members or your opponent, just let us know somehow that you're having issues and we'll pause the proceedings and try to get the technology back working. So with that, the next and final matter on our oral argument calendar for this morning is in the matter of the welfare of the child of J.R.W. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Carlson. I'm a contractor with Adult Representation Services out of Hennepin County, and I represent the father in this matter, J.R.W. We are requesting that this court would reverse the adjudication that his daughter is in need of protection or services and remand with instructions for the child to be returned home and for the matter to be dismissed. This is a case with a great deal of procedural irregularity at best, where the child was adjudicated 318 days after she was removed from the home. Respondent's argument is that it doesn't matter that it took 318 days because my client did not prevail at trial. It's unsettling to think about what would have happened had he prevailed at trial, had the child been kept from his home for 318 days, and had the court found that Hennepin County did not meet its burden of proving that the child was in need of protection or services. Regardless, there are two different questions that the court needs to look at. One is whether or not the child is in need of protection or services, but the other is also whether or not the child's welfare cannot be adequately safeguarded without removal. And this question should have been in front of the court at every single hearing leading up to the adjudication. I don't know how you can have a permanency progress review hearing 3 or 4 months prior to an adjudication. It doesn't make any sense to me. How can you assess whether or not a parent has made progress with a case plan that they haven't been ordered to comply with? In this case, I do not believe that the record contains sufficient evidence to support a finding that the only way to ensure this child's safety and welfare was for her to be removed from the care of her father. It seems very obvious that the one way that her safety and welfare could have been adequately safeguarded would have been to place her under the protective supervision of the agency with instructions to not use any physical discipline in the home. I also find it somewhat challenging to believe that this really fits the statutory definition of 260C.007 subdivision 6 subparent 2, which, as respondent points out, has changed since the time the petition was originally filed to include Minnesota statute 260E. That in and of itself is problematic. At the time that the petition was filed, Minnesota statute 260E was not pled in the original petition here, filed March 17th, 2020. This child has been out of the home for 16 months, and that delay has substantially prejudiced my client in matters that in any number of manners, including the fact that he has not been able to seek review of these proceedings. Respondent's argument is that he could have asked for discretionary review at some point prior to this hearing, or that there were remedies available that he did not previously ask for. I do not believe that the district court has the discretion to decide which timelines outlined by the rules of juvenile protection procedure it chooses to comply with.
So Ms. Carlson, I do want to focus in a little bit on the due process argument that you're making concerning the delay in the trial. And it seems to me as though the county is arguing waiver, or at least, you know, failure to object. And I'm just hoping that you can respond to that argument. I know that the records show a trial was requested at every step of the way, and yet I don't see any record indicating that there was any objection made to the delays in this case, any specific objection to that.
Your Honor, ignorance for the law is no excuse to not comply with it. And in this case, the district court was apparently ignorant of the laws that say this is when the trial has to happen. I mean, the record reflects that the district court is aware that timelines are a concern in a child protection matter. I think that's abundantly clear to anyone that practices child protection law. I would disagree with any argument that the specific error that I'm pointing out to this court, the specific error is that the district court erred in denying father a trial repeatedly, which he does not have an affirmative duty to request. He is entitled to a trial. Now, that his counsel at the district court level did not make more of a scene about this than I have does not mean that the argument is waived. It just means that he wasn't able to seek review of these proceedings in earlier time. But that does not waive the argument. And actually, I would say that the fact that the respondent is arguing that everything is waived, if anything, goes to show how much my client was substantially prejudiced by the delay. Respondent is arguing that every single error from the emergency protective care hearing up until the adjudication, that I can't argue that before this court because it wasn't adequately before the district court. Well, that in and of itself goes to show that there was a substantial prejudice towards my client in that these arguments couldn't have been made timely. Here I am making an argument about something that happened March 20th of 2020 on July 8th, 2021. I should have been able to make this argument back last summer. That would have been the appropriate time for me to make it.
What are we to make of the fact that about your client's lack of participation in the voluntary plan?
Your Honor, I don't believe it's a consideration under 260C.201. I understand that my client on this record perhaps has some behavior that has been perceived as unsavory by the parties, the district court, the guardian ad litem, and the child. However, I think that a parent's participation and compliance with a case plan is absolutely relevant if we're looking at a permanency disposition, including anything under Minnesota statute 260C.301 or 260C.515 sub 4. But at this point in time, I don't believe that compliance with a voluntary case plan was something that my client had an affirmative duty to prove prior to the child's adjudication. I don't think it should have been considered at a permanency progress review hearing that happened in September. The question is whether or not the child is in need of protection or services and whether or not her safety and welfare cannot be adequately safeguarded without removal. Her safety and welfare could have been adequately safeguarded without removal and should have. That would have been the correct way for the county to have applied the law in this matter, not keep her out of the home for 318 days before reaching a determination that she can't be returned, Your Honor.
Okay. And then are you disputing that the finding that there was physical abuse? And I know there's more to it, you know, that you just outlined in your argument of whether she was a child in need of protective services. But on that one, that just under the definition of physical abuse, are you challenging the judge's finding there?
I'm challenging the finding for this reason. It's one thing to find physical abuse under 260E. That relates to mandatory reporters, and that relates to people that have to report various physical mandatory reporters and what they are required to report to maintain their professional licensure or otherwise. There's still the other half of the analysis that's missing from this court's order, which is, why does this child need protection or services? Why does this family need protection or services? And why does it serve this child's best interests to receive services? The fact that there's a potential for a future harm that is not currently in front of the court is not a sufficient reason to remove a child from the home. Hypotheticals and, what ifs are not a reason for the child to be removed from the home and kept from the home for a period of 318 days. There needs to be something that is preventing the child's safe return at the time that the child is adjudicated as in need of protection or services. And for me, two altercations that took place on March 17th, 2020 is not sufficient evidence to find that those altercations would have continued to take place up until February 1st, 2021. And if anything, the delay there would show that the conditions by the time this adjudication order was issued were no longer before the court. The court has to address conditions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh, yeah. So, Ms. Carlson, I just want to go back to your statutory argument concerning the district court's use of the maltreatment statute. Doesn't 260C actually refer to that statute for the definition of physical abuse? And given that cross-reference, maybe you can clear up for me what the error, the statutory error that you're alleging was.
Thank you, Your Honor. It does now reflect 260E. And I would withdraw my argument that there is a problem with the district court giving analysis to 260E when looking at 260C.007 subdivision 6 subparent 2. I would note that at the time the petition was filed, the statute did not reflect 260E. And that I have the petition in front of me, and the version of the statute that was cited in the petition does not cite to 260E. However, to the degree that I'm arguing that the analysis under 260E was inappropriate, I withdraw that argument respectfully. That I recognize that the law did change from the time the petition was filed up until the time that the adjudication order was issued.
So can I ask one other quick question? So we're dealing with an older child here. So what, and I am mindful of your argument about now it's a whole year later, et cetera, before the adjudication on whether or not the child was a child in need of protection or services. But what does that, how does that factor in? I mean, the issue about, and it came up in the context of visitation, I guess, you know, that the child did not want visits with the father. And that, how should we weigh that or look at that, or is it not relevant?
Your Honor, thank you for that question. And I have really struggled with the visitation in this case, recognizing that at the time that the petition was filed, it was a 16-year-old child. Who now is going to be turning 18, I believe, in November, and that the child was granted the discretion to determine when she wanted visitation, and that the child, who has a number of issues, determined that she did not want to have visitation. My read of the statute is pretty clear. The agency has to provide a visitation plan that is approved by the district court, and the district court does not have the license to shirk that responsibility and say, well, the child can figure it out. If the child wants contact, that's fine. If the child doesn't want contact, whatever the child wants. Especially
so just to follow up on that, I'm just wondering what the source of your authority is there, that the district court in its discretion can't tailor visitation as it did here.
Minnesota Statute 260C.201, Subdivision 5. No parent may be denied visitation unless the court finds at the disposition hearing that visitation would endanger the safety and welfare of the child. We didn't have a disposition hearing until after the adjudication. I mean, you can't have a disposition hearing until after the adjudication. And the way that I read 260C.201 sub 5 is that from the time of the EPC up until the adjudication, there's no authority to deny a parent visitation. The court is required to approve the agency's plan for visitation because at that point in time, everything in front of it is just allegations. Are there any further questions I can answer at this time regarding my brief or these arguments?
Well, you will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time after you hear your opponent support the district court's decision.
Then I would yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacob McKnight, and I represent the respondent, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. It's important to be clear in this case as to what this case is about and what this case is not about. Appellant believes that this case is about a delay in the CHIPS trial that was reasonable and appropriate due to the significant challenges in court administration and the scheduling of trials during the early months of the global pandemic. But that is not what this case is about. This case is about appellant's physical abuse of his child on the evening of March 17th, 2020, when he physically assaulted his child twice, causing observable and disturbing injuries to the child's neck. And this case is about the fact that appellant denies any wrongdoing, minimizes his conduct, blames the child for the assaults, and refuses to engage in services that would ensure his child's safety in his care. I do want to respond specifically to some of counsel's arguments just now. This argument about Section 260C.007, Subdivision 6, paren 2, which I may refer to as the physical abuse ground or CHIPS adjudication ground. She's indicating that that now incorporates the maltreatment statute 260E.007 regarding the definition of physical abuse. However, this wasn't really a change in the law. This was a change in the numbering of the law. If you look at the 2018 statute of 260C.007 subdivision 6 paren 2, it refers to the earlier version of the maltreatment statute, which was section 626.556 for the definition of physical abuse. And so I wasn't exactly sure what counsel was referring to about withdrawing an argument, but I just wanted to be clear that even though the numbering had changed, the substance of that provision did not change whatsoever. Regarding the waiver issue of appellant's argument on appeal regarding the timing of trial, essentially appellant is arguing that because CHIPS trial did not happen within 60 days, there should be a reversal and a return of the child to the father. And both in appellant's brief as well as now on oral argument, the exact issue or claim that's being raised on appeal is actually being misconstrued, I would submit. The issue is not whether appellant's trial counsel was making requests for a trial before the district court. And I would point out that respondents' trial counsel also made that request at one of the hearings as well. The issue is whether appellant's trial counsel made an argument to the district court that because a trial hasn't happened within 60 days, the case needs to be dismissed. And that trial counsel had several opportunities to make that argument at the pretrials in May and in June of 2020, also at the beginning of the trial and at the pretrial in August of 2020. And certainly by the time at the beginning of trial, appellant's trial counsel could have made that argument and failed to make that argument. So this is absolutely a case of waiver under Thiel v. Stitch. In order for appellant to prevail in this appeal, he needs to prove that the district court abused its discretion as to all three CHIPS adjudication grounds that were determined. Appellant has not and cannot do this. As I argue in my brief, there's clear and convincing evidence to sustain all three grounds, and there is overwhelming evidence to sustain the physical abuse ground, that subdivision 6 paren 2. Appellant isn't even seriously disputing subdivision 6 paren 2 on appeal. And again, that's the department's, the respondent's strongest ground. Appellant doesn't challenge the district court's underlying or ultimate findings of fact regarding the physical abuse, and therefore those findings should be upheld. Appellant makes only four narrow arguments about the physical abuse ground in both his principal and reply briefs. First, this issue that's already been discussed about appellant misconstruing the structure of the statutory provision, which incorporates the definition of physical abuse from the maltreatment statute. Second, appellant claims that the district court failed to identify what services the family is in need of. However, the district court plainly stated the case plan that it was ordering on page 15 of the CHIPS adjudication order.
Can I jump in and ask you a little bit about the timeliness issue? What does the record teach us as to the reason? You've pointed to the pandemic, but is it your position that the pandemic justifies the entire length of the delay?
Thank you, Your Honor. I was certainly wanting to address that. The respondent is not disagreeing that Rule 49.01, Subdivision 1, requires a trial within 60 days of the Emergency Protective Care hearing. However, Rule 49.01, Subdivision 2, provides that the court may on its own motion continue the trial for certain reasons, including other good cause shown. And here, as I pointed out in my brief, there was other good cause shown, which was the global pandemic. That pandemic severely disrupted court proceedings at all levels. Appellant's case opened, I believe the petition was filed on March 20th of 2020. That was at the very beginning stages of the pandemic. And his case was certainly not unique in being disrupted.
I understand that. My question is it the state's position that, or the county's position, that the entire period is attributable and justifiable based upon the pandemic?
Your Honor, it's my... It's respondent's position that those initial continuances were justified and based on the pandemic. At that May 13th, 2020 pretrial, which was the first pretrial, in its order, the district court explicitly declined to set a trial due to scheduling difficulties caused by the pandemic. And that is other good cause shown to continue the trial or to have a delay in setting the trial. A month later, at the June 26th, 2020 pretrial hearing, both parties requested a trial. However, the district court declined to set that trial and didn't give us an explicit reason for that. However, I would submit that it's reasonable to infer that the disruptions caused by the pandemic were still taking place a month and a half after that, that that's the same other good cause shown to continue the trial or to delay in setting a trial.
Let me ask it a different way. What percentage of the delay, I'm sure you agree this was an extraordinarily long delay. What percentage of the overall delay do you believe is justifiable based upon the pandemic?
And I apologize if I'm not getting to your answer quickly enough, Your Honor. I would say that so those first two pretrials, when the court delayed in setting a trial, those can be directly attributable to the pandemic. And then the next hearing on August 26th, the district court did set trial dates. And so it's respondents' position that under these unprecedented circumstances, appellant did have a timely trial. The district court did not err.
So just so I'm clear, you're saying that you believe that 100% of the lengthy delay is justifiable under the pandemic circumstances.
That's correct, Your Honor. So along those lines, so because...
I'm going to go back to this delay issue here. So in terms of trying to explain the delay, whether it's pandemic related, whether it's other issues, who bears the burden here of demonstrating that the delay was for good cause at each step of the way? Would it be the county? Would it be DAD? I'm interested to hear your response to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court delayed setting the trial, as we're all aware, for several months. And if appellant's trial counsel had felt that that was a due process violation or that was an automatic reversal, then appellant's trial counsel needed to make that argument. And that's my entire point about waiver. And so on appeal, I would submit that it is appellant's obligation to show that the district court somehow erred or abused its discretion, but not only erred, but that error was prejudicial. And even if there is error, there's certainly no reversible error because appellant cannot show prejudice. Appellant has argued that his due process rights were violated by a delay in trial. He asserts that if he'd had a trial within 60 days, he would have reunified with his child sooner. That argument is completely speculative. It's also doubtful because when there was a trial, he did not prevail and he did not reunify with his child. I would also submit that if anything, the delay in trial benefited appellant by allowing him more time to work his case plan so that he could safely reunify and show that he can safely parent. Of course, he chose to not engage whatsoever. Appellant's due process rights were not violated in this case. He had an notice. He had an opportunity to be heard. And again, I would submit that under these circumstances, this was a timely trial. He had counsel at trial who zealously advocated for him. He was able to testify and call witnesses. He was able to offer evidence and cross-examine the respondents' witnesses and evidence. He had an impartial fact finder. if I could get back to the issue that the appellant is not seriously disputing the the physical abuse ground, which is subdivision 6 paren 2. Again, he's not challenging the district court's underlying or ultimate findings of fact in either of his briefs, and therefore those findings should be upheld. He makes only these four narrow arguments. I think I was kind of in the middle of those. His third argument is that the district court didn't explain why the services in the case plan promoted the safety and well-being of the child. That is self-evident because services such as a parenting assessment, individual therapy, domestic violence, anger management would help him control his anger, properly discipline the child, and safely parent her. And finally, appellant suggests that the district court is speculating about a potential future harm. There's simply nothing speculative when the record convincingly shows that appellant assaulted his child twice and fails to take responsibility and those other arguments.
I know with Judge Ross's permission, if I could interject for a minute, what's troubling me is that there was physical abuse. There were the marks on her neck. But it came out of kind of a single evening's activities. And so taking her out of the home for an extended period of time, I mean, how is that justified under the statute?
Thank you, Your Honor. This incident that culminated in the physical abuse on March 17th, it was a ramping up in the early months of 2020. So that needs to be taken in the context. It was two assaults, violent assaults on that night. And again, he's done nothing to show that he's rehabilitated himself whatsoever. Could I briefly close, Your Honor? I know I'm out of time.
Sure, you're out of time, but go ahead and take a moment to summarize.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, which I cite in my brief, that the paramount consideration in all juvenile protection proceedings, the health, safety, best interests of the child, to grant appellant his requested relief, which is an outright reversal, is completely inconsistent with that. To do so would be to return a child to her abuser without the abuser making any rehabilitation. And we would request that the court affirm the order. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
To be clear about what my argument is, it is that this court should reverse because the evidence is insufficient to support the district court's findings that this child should be adjudicated as in need of protection or services. Pursuant to all three statutory grounds, I find the evidence is insufficient, and that is the reason that I am asking for a reversal. I am addressing the delay because I do not want to see this happen to other families in the state of Minnesota.
Well, when you say you're addressing the delay, you're arguing, you're making a legal argument based upon the delay. And I'm trying to get a sense of why. I mean, I understand your argument that your client was entitled to a timely hearing, whether or not he raised a request. But why is it that you have not, that your client has not forfeited the argument under Thiel v. Stitch by not having presented it as a basis for a legal determination in the district court?
Your Honor, this was a big struggle for me, figuring out what sort of relief I could ask for from this court based on the fact that it took 318 days for this child to be adjudicated as in need of protection or services.
And when I understand that it wasn't, you weren't the one who set the table, but yet you're stuck with the meal. So what's your legal argument around the county's position as to the county's contention that we should apply Thiel v. Stitch to deem that argument forfeited?
I would argue that this court is not nearly as weak as the respondent is trying to suggest by saying that there is nothing that this court can do by way of commenting on this delay and clarifying the fact that this sort of delay is not an acceptable way for juvenile courts to conduct themselves. Juvenile courts do not have the discretion to decide they want to abide by some timelines outlined by the rules and not others.
Oh, I see. So you're asking more for an editorial advisory comment, not a basis for reversal.
Well, the reason I'm asking for reversal is because the evidence is insufficient
to support
the adjudication. When it comes to timing, I believe it's per se prejudicial to delay a child protection proceeding for 318 days when the rules of juvenile protection procedure say 60. I believe that the delay in and of itself, I would love to argue that that's grounds for reversal. I'm arguing that grounds for reversal is insufficient evidence, but I'm asking this court to find that it's per se prejudicial to delay a child protection proceeding this far into the case for a number of reasons. One, you have to address conditions that exist at the time of the trial. And when it takes 318 days to issue an order, you aren't addressing conditions that exist at the time of the trial. Two, the arguments about the fact that he could have benefited from some services in the meantime, I find that to be a bit of a red herring here. I don't think that whether or not he could have benefited from services really is to his, does go to the question of whether or not this child is in need of protection or services and whether or not her receiving protection or services is in her best interest.
No one has raised the issue of mootness, and perhaps it doesn't apply because I don't think daughter has graduated high school, but what is daughter's age at this time? Am I correct that she's 18 or fast approaching 18?
Your Honor, I believe that the child is going to be turning 18 in November, and I recognize that this court has to issue an order on or before August 23rd, 2021, 45 days after this oral argument.
Well, it's not moot in any case.
I mean, the appeal has been perfected. I believe that the appeal has been perfected and that this court, of course, has the ability to address the issues that appellant is raising. Appellant's position is still that he wants his daughter returned to his care. He does not want the county to continue to move forward with these proceedings. He wants frequent visitation, as should have been provided to him from the day of the emergency protective care hearing, regardless of the child's position. He is asking this court to help correct the wrongs that occurred over the last year and a half that have prevented him from having a relationship with his daughter. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, not just for your time, but for your arguments and your passion. Obviously, this is a matter of great concern for everyone. Child protection cases always are. And of course, we have to put our emotion on the table and deal with it strictly on the law, which we will do, and we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that being our last oral argument case of the day, we are in recess. Thank you.